Hello, welcome to The Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. At 3:03 p.m. Washington, D.C. local time on March the 30th, a spring afternoon, computers at the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon detect a radar signal. 6 seconds previously, it indicates, a missile was launched from somewhere 20 miles outside Pyongyang, North Korea. It's a Hwasong-17, North Korea's most powerful intercontinental ballistic missile, and it's headed towards the United States. Alarms sound, predetermined protocols are activated, urgent messages are sent to the President, America's most senior defense officials, and to her nuclear arsenal around the world. But as orders are accessed and the United States responds, a string of terrible happenstances, missed calls on red phones, misinterpreted radar signals, rash decisions at the top, protocols that don't work out as planned, all unleash an appalling cascade of escalation. It becomes clear that the deterrence doctrine of mutually assured destruction has failed. Russia is drawn into the conflict. Climate-changing decisions, which will result in the deaths of hundreds of millions of innocent people, are compressed into periods as short as 6 minutes. No one knows why North Korea has attacked the United States. No one ever will. Nuclear war is happening for no clear reason, and no one can stop it. Everyone thinks they have trained for this. No one is prepared for it. What happens over the next 58 minutes will kill billions of people and end human civilization. This is not science fiction. It is a realistic timeline laid out in horrifying detail in Nuclear War, a scenario by the Pulitzer-nominated author Annie Jacobson. An exhaustively researched book based on hitherto classified information and interviews with military and civilian experts, and also people who have both built nuclear weapons and planned nuclear war, it details second by second the steps from a single missile launch to a scarcely comprehensible worldwide Holocaust. It is the most terrifying thing I have ever read. Annie Jacobson is here with me today to talk about it. Hello, Annie. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for that introduction.
I cannot describe the fear your book put in me. I had to read it in 10-page installments and take a break every now and again. The scale of events and the detail of the carnage that's inflicted on cities and millions of people is almost unbearable. Did you understand when you embarked on this project exactly how horrific it was going to be?
No, I didn't. So I had a similar experience writing and reporting the book, almost in 10-page increments, that you had reading it.
As you researched this book, what were those steps, those shocks? What surprised you as you researched it? Because we tend to fool ourselves that we're familiar with the concept of nuclear war and how it could happen. But it becomes very, very clear as I read this book that I don't know anything at all.
Yes. Well, okay, so to back up a pinch, previously I've written 6 books on the military and the intelligence community in the United States. And imagine how many people in these books have told me that they have dedicated their lives to preventing nuclear World War III. And I say this because many of the people I've interviewed over my reporting career, you know, were in their 80s and 90s when I interviewed them. So we're talking about me reporting on all the wars since, including World War II. And so the idea of this book was, what happens if deterrence fails? And I take the reader step by step through precisely what happens, because I think that is the most effective way to demonstrate, as you said, in appalling detail, just how horrific nuclear World War III would be, and shockingly how fast. The book, as you know, takes place over a period of 72 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that struck me more than anything was the fact that ICBMs once launched can't be recalled. I just assumed that somewhere there was a kind of off switch, a return button. But effectively, one phrase that recurs is, what's done cannot be undone.
And I think the 1-2 punch on that realization that you just said is, okay, the first punch is this. The president of the United States has sole authority to launch nuclear weapons. And presidents of the United States, I learned, are woefully unprepared and uneducated about the nuclear triad. And so the second of the two lung punches there is that President Reagan once gave a statement in 1983 at a press conference, which was picked up by the New York Times, where he misstated that ballistic nuclear missiles launched from submarines could be recalled. And so, as you said in your opening, the scenario that unfolds in my book, Nuclear War, A Scenario, is this series of missteps with extraordinary and apocalyptic consequences.
What made you want to write this book?
During COVID, when President Trump was the president here in the United States, and there was talk of, if you remember from international headlines, fire and fury, there was a kind of a conflict and then a sort of false brotherhood going on between President Trump and the president of North Korea. And that stirred up a lot of agitation inside the nuclear command and control community here in the United States. And if you're someone who writes about, you know, military and intelligence programs as an investigative journalist, as I do, those things kind of became evident. I began to notice, as one example, that high-ranking officials at STRATCOM, Strategic Command, that sort of controls the nuclear arsenal here in the United States, those commanders and deputy commanders were going on the record, and you could watch this on C-SPAN, discussing with members of Congress who were extremely concerned about what might happen. And in those transparent disclosures here in the United States, I began to realize, oh, actually, nuclear command and control is really uncomfortable with this volatility. And maybe, just maybe, some of these individuals who normally don't talk to an investigative journalist like me might talk. And I found out very quickly that they would, and they did. And so in the book, I have 46, you know, top echelon national security people, advisors to the president, except, and on down, who spoke to me on the record. And that's how I was able to report the book factually as a scenario.
It's very worth highlighting that you do not spare the detail of what actually happens to human beings and their surroundings when a nuclear weapon detonates. The people inside the miles-wide fireballs that result are in a certain sense lucky because they are just vaporized. But outside, in the outer ring, people burst into flame. They're flayed alive. They're blinded. They're impaled. Those who don't die immediately are irradiated or will die of starvation and dehydration. Did you feel you had a duty? Because this, I can't lie, it made me feel physically ill. But did you feel you had a duty to spell this out?
You know, that's a really interesting and complex question. And of course, I weighed those ideas out in my own mind because I'm often reporting on grim subjects. But ultimately, my job as a reporter is to report. And so the bitter and terrible and tragic and horrifying irony of those details you just relayed to me, those come directly out of an army manual. It's been renamed The Effects of Nuclear Weapons, but its original title was like Army Manual Number 50.2. And these were the details that were compiled by the Defense Department starting after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, reporting on what atomic bombs do to people and to things. And then this manual became expanded into a massive tome as the United States began its atmospheric weapons testing during the Cold War in the 1950s. And then when the development of this thermonuclear bomb came to be, called the super, this raised the order of magnitude of death and destruction to a degree that is incomprehensible unless you read those manuals. And then you see that horrific detail, because that's what the Defense Department does. Like, for example, I can tell you, based on the facts and the data in those books and those manuals, at what distance out from a 1 megaton thermonuclear weapon, pine needles will catch on fire, versus at what distance upholstery in an automobile will catch on fire. Mm. And when you see that grotesque specificity, if you're me, you say, I have to report this and let the people know. Because really the point of this book is for people to read this and be horrified and have a conversation about what it means to be on the razor's edge of Armageddon 24/7, 365 days a year. All of us. What does that mean? And why are we passively not only just letting this happen, but as we see in current events today, escalate to the point of very serious threats of nuclear war?
Part of that serious threat, and the way the escalation is driven in your scenario, is the recurring theme of errors and unforeseen reactions. I sort of like hinted at some earlier on. Amongst the, in your scenario, there are moments when the Russians refuse to take a call from the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is effectively, you know, pretty much the supreme voice, because he's not the president. But the president himself is lying in a field with a broken leg, bleeding out of parachuting out of a helicopter, but the Russians refuse to take the call. Or American Russians, which are heading for Korea in a retaliatory strike, have to cross Russian territory, and the Russians think they're being attacked. It's like you're reading this stuff going, did nobody foresee that this might be the scenario?
Absolutely. And one of the most shocking interviews I did, because, of course, all of those scenarios that you're talking about, if someone wants to really nerd out on this book, or even if they just say, wait a minute, she's going, you know, over the line here, how, go to the notes and you will see the interviews I did with people, with Secret Service agents who would have to take the president out of the White House in this, you know, radical maneuver to get him there before the bomb hits Washington, D.C., or the Secretary of Defense making a decision. I did interviews with actual secretaries of defense, with actual directors of Secret Service, to be able to report this factually. But to your point about these errors and these miscalculations, one of the most powerful interviews I did was with Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. He's retired now. Before Panetta was the SecDef, he was the director of the CIA. And before that, he was the White House chief of staff during the Clinton administration. So he has this long career of service. He knows these different jobs where he's at the highest position he could hold in those individual lanes. And he was able to explain to me how different those roles are, but how for the Secretary of Defense, only when you become Secretary of Defense do you realize the weight of the possibility of nuclear war. And as Panetta explained to me, you almost know more than the president, because most presidents are occupied with, you know, politics, what's happening in the White House, the day to day. And it was Panetta who gave me this quote in the book that really, you know, sends a chill up the reader's spine, I think, where he spoke about how once the bombs start flying, no one is really thinking about the mistakes.
Do any of these guys, when they take office, is there a point in the kind of induction program where they're taken aside and gone, okay, right, this afternoon we're going to run through a simulated nuclear attack so that you can familiarize yourself with the decision-making process? Because what leaps out from your book is that nobody seems prepared. There's a huge set of protocols. There are books upon books of procedures to follow. And yet everybody seems incapable of making an independent decision and falls back on a system that's almost designed to escalate.
You're absolutely on point there. As far as the nuclear command and control is concerned, the sequence of events, once the STRATCOM commander receives orders to launch, those events, like you said, are on the books, right? There is no debate. There is no room for debate. It is simply launch. What I found terrifying was what happens before that launch order is so perilous and happens so fast that that is the room for the errors. And to your point, or your question rather, about the president, from what I understand, and I did not interview any presidents for the book, but from what I understand from secretaries of defenses and people in the CIA and the people who might do the pre-briefings, the president gets that early pre-brief where he learns in a very general, broad way what his responsibility is as commander-in-chief were there to be a nuclear launch against America. And that is why he knows that he's going to have to give the command, and he has sole authority to do it. He doesn't ask anyone. He doesn't ask permission of the SECDEF, not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and not Congress. We have a launch on warning procedure in the United States. If we learn that a nuclear missile is coming toward the continental United States, we have a policy that goes into effect called launch on warning. It is precisely as it sounds. The president does not wait to absorb a nuclear blow and then make a decision. He launches because that ballistic missile is going to hit in 30 minutes or less. That's where the chaos happens. And that's what I tried to describe, you know, effectively in my book so people can realize what madness this is.
I think one of the truly powerful things about it is that because, you know, your background, as we'll talk about in a minute, is not just in factual journalism, but it's also in fiction and thrillers. You place the reader right in those rooms where those decisions are being taken, or in many cases not taken, and you feel the panic and you feel the weight of events. And I think that upset me just as much as the thought of what actually happens to those millions of people at the various ground zeros you described. There is another recurring theme, which is that when we see that deterrence backed by the threat of mutually assured destruction fails and that escalation has begun, knowledge that your country is about to be destroyed does not stop the war continuing. And there is an absolutely chilling moment when the next in line to replace the president, who is lost and presumed dead, effectively says, look, hundreds of millions of Americans are now going to die. We can't stop it. What is the point in killing 600 million Russians? And nothing happens. He's barely heard. He's hardly even shouted down. The procedure rolls on. And that scared me really deeply. What did you base that on? Did you base that on knowledge of the kind of people who were doing this or the protocol regime?
Yes. You're referring to what used to be called the PSYOP, the Single Integrated Operational Plan for Nuclear War. Now it's just called the OPLAN, the operational plan. But that PSYOP is a jealously guarded secret and has been for decades, with one exception. And that was, there was a small, very thin, under 100-page memoir written by a guy called John Rubel, who was part, he sat in the underground bunker underneath Strategic Air Command in Nebraska in 1960 when the first PSYOP was presented to the president. And not for decades would he reveal those essentially classified details. Not for decades. But when he was an old man in his 80s, he felt, and you can, when you, if you read his memoir, and I footnote it all in the back that this is where this comes from, he felt this extraordinary remorse. And he even uses the word, you know, extermination. He wrote that he felt that he was part of a mass extermination plan and was shocked by his own behavior that he didn't speak up. One person spoke up, as you reference, the Commandant of the Marines, but no one else did. And that this remains secret for so many decades is fascinating. And I don't even know what's more fascinating, the fact that John Rubel had this epiphany to reveal it to the public on his deathbed, in essence. But when he did reveal it, America was in the middle of the War on Terror, in the early days of the War on Terror. And so the memoir kind of went unnoticed. I found it, read about it, reported on it. And so in my discussions with former secretaries of defenses and others who advised the president, national security advisors, I was able to say, hey, this is what John Rubel wrote in his memoir. What do you think about this? And I was able to unearth their mental thoughts on that and also their emotional thoughts on that. And one of the most powerful other interviews I did with the Secretary of Defense was William Perry, who's now in his 90s. And he has real remorse about the nuclear weapon industry and the threat that it poses. And so he was very forthcoming with me. And some of the scenario points, like, for example, when the Secretary of Defense in my book makes a decision to leave the Pentagon and take a helicopter out to a bunker called Raven Rock, which is the alternate National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon. SecDef Perry told me that is what he would do because he would begin to be thinking about what to do next. And that revelation, not to give too much away in the book, where I have a Secretary of Defense going through exactly a similar mental state that John Rubel raised in his memoir that you talk about. And so the readers are able to see, I believe, as close as possible to the real sentiments that might unfold based on these national security upper echelon people having to weigh their role in the military, their role in the chain of command, with their morality.
I want to ask you about another particularly grotesque aspect of the scenario that you play out, which is that North Korea doesn't just attack Washington, D.C. It also destroys a nuclear reactor in a coastal part of California, Diablo Canyon, near San Luis Obispo. Washington, D.C. is a military target. It would be an appalling war crime to attack it with a nuclear weapon, but it is an active military strategy. Attacking Diablo Canyon and rendering hundreds of square miles of rural California uninhabitable potentially for thousands of years just seems wanton, the idea to destroy and contaminate. How truthful is that as regards nuclear strategy? Because obviously, I mean, as it plays out in the book, this is to deprive a large swathe of California of power and therefore further weaken the United States. But how truthful is that kind of attack to what you found?
Well, again, I'm writing nuclear war, a scenario. And so you're saying, maybe you're asking, how did I decide to include that almost, you know, that abominable idea in the scenario? Well, I was watching what was happening on the news in Ukraine as the war unfolded there. And I was witnessing the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant become the target of attacks in its vicinity, which is a direct violation of the Geneva Protocols, what's called Rule 42 by the International Red Cross, which says you never attack a nuclear power plant. It's potentially too horrific. If you were to have a core meltdown of a nuclear reactor, the land would be rendered uninhabitable for thousands of years. And this was almost happening in Ukraine. And just look at the, you know, the websites for the international community on this kind of behavior. They're incensed, but almost no one is paying attention to it because there's many other things people are worrying about right now. But this is a very serious threat. And I chose very specifically to include it in the scenario. And when you report things, of course, you have your multiple sources, nuclear experts who have written papers about this kind of thing for decades. You go to anyone you can really think of. And ultimately, I took that scenario in an early draft to Dr. Glenn McDuff of Los Alamos, who's a nuclear weapons engineer, worked on projects for decades, served as the classified museum historian there at the lab, right? And he said to me, it's actually worse, meaning the results of what you are writing about would be worse were a nuclear reactor to be hit by a nuclear weapon. And he directed me to even more documentation where I could source the potential reality of what would happen were that to happen with even more appalling detail. And I put it all in the book for exactly the reason that we were just speaking of, that I really believe people should be aware of just how crazy of a threat the use of any nuclear weapon would be. It will almost certainly lead to wide world war.
You're also a writer-producer for TV in fiction, for series including Jack Ryan on Amazon. Fiction and movies have given us the idea of the post-nuclear world. You know, Mad Max, Logan's Run, Planet of the Apes, Judge Dredd. You make it very, very clear that there isn't going to be one. Do you think pop culture bears a little bit of responsibility for kind of inuring us against the nuclear threat, for making us, because you know, there's no doubt that since the end of the Cold War, it has receded and only come sharply back into focus since the Ukraine war, really.
When I was in high school, I had a very impactful moment that speaks to your question. There was a television show called The Day After. And it aired in 1983. And if you read, it was about nuclear war between the United States and Russia, really sort of ICBM-based nuclear war, and the horrific aftermath. And that television show was watched by 100 million Americans. It was fictional, but it was based in reality. And the really impactful part wasn't just me as a young woman being terrified of nuclear war. It's what happened next, which is that I learned President Reagan also watched The Day After, and he became depressed after watching it. Those are his words. And he rang up Gorbachev, and the two of them had a summit. And after that summit, 2 years later, the White House called the filmmakers of The Day After, the writer and the producer and the director, and said, if you guys think you don't have anything to do with this summit and this arms reduction that Gorbachev and I just did, you're wrong, because you did. And that's when I realized narrative storytelling can have a profound impact on leaders, not just on citizens.
Yeah, we had a similar show in the UK called Threads, which is kind of part of the, it's almost become part of the British folklore. It's an attack on Sheffield, which is a city in the middle of Britain. And anyone who saw that, it's kind of seared on your mind. You know, the 80s seemed to be so dominated by a kind of background hum of nuclear fear. Do you think we've allowed ourselves to be fooled since then, that the end of the Cold War meant that the nuclear threat has receded?
Well, that is certainly why some of my elder statesmen, cold warriors, went on record with me, because they shared with me that they feared that much of the world had been lulled into passivity, that many people had forgotten about these threats, which were so relevant in the 1980s. And part of their going on the record with me was to support this idea that people need to know. That was an exact quote that Secretary Panetta gave me. He said, Annie, I'm glad you're doing this. The people need to know.
Finally, I have to ask you, the stuff that you go through in this book, as is clear, it as a reader, I was profoundly upset and I felt a fool for not thinking about this. You know, I'm in my 50s. I am one of those people who thought this threat has receded. I felt like an idiot for not paying attention. I want to ask you, as you wrote this stuff and as you looked at these horrors, not just the effect of nuclear weapons, but the horrors that humans have built, systems that are built to go wrong, how have you held onto your equilibrium and your sanity looking at this stuff?
You know, I'm an optimist at heart. I just must have come out of the chute that way, because I'm also really about communication, and I believe that all problems can be solved by discussion. You might call me a Pollyanna, but that is absolutely my truth. You know, I don't write about politics for a real specific reason. I don't want to get drawn into an argument. I write about POTUS, the President of the United States, because I believe that whatever side of the aisle you are on, you actually probably really believe that you might be right. And so what is the point of just shouting at one another in an echo chamber? One, people should communicate. I think this goes for citizens, and it certainly goes for world leaders.
Annie Jacobson, thanks for joining me to talk about this. And the book you've written is an incredible feat of reporting and research. I think it deserves to be read extremely widely. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nuclear War, A Scenario is published now by Torva. You can get it through our affiliate bookshop. There's a link in the show notes. I urge you to read it. You will not enjoy it, but you'll be closer to the truth about something that's been part of all of our lives since the days of Oppenheimer. Thank you for listening. I've been Andrew Harrison. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis-Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.